Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Most Notorious Podcast, a story of a turn of the 19th century Australian convict who escapes his captors, heads into the wilderness, and isn't heard from again for over 30 years.
So he was found by the Aboriginal people. I think it was three women found him half dead on the banks of a river with the spear of a warrior they knew.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Great to have you here with me. Hope you're doing well in these difficult times. I am so pleased to have as my guest today, Adam Courtney. He is a Sydney-based writer and journalist with a long career in the UK and Australia. He is also an Australian historian and has written five books. His latest is called The Ghost and the Bounty Hunter, and it is the subject of this week's episode. Thank you so much for agreeing to spend some time with me.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on, Eric.
Absolutely. So, first question, where did you get the inspiration to write this book?
Well, I was told about this. We had this expression in Australia called, you've got buck leaves. And what it means is you've got no chance whatsoever. And it's been an expression we've had in the country for about 150 years, and no one is quite sure where it comes from, but people believe it comes from this man, William Buckley. So a friend of mine said he saw an art exhibition about William Buckley. Now, William Buckley was a convict who came to Australia from Cheshire in England, and he came as a convict in 1803, but they abandoned that particular settlement. But before they abandoned it, he ran away. And now the thing about Buckley was he was 6'5", highly athletic, a really huge, strong bloke. And we think the expression, you've got Buckley's, comes from the fact that Buckley survived in the wilderness, whereas nobody else did in those days. And he survived for about 3 or 4 months after having escaped from the initial settlement. And eventually was picked up half dead by Aboriginal people in the Port Phillip area, which is where Melbourne is now in the southern part of Australia. And so we got this expression, you've got Buckley's, and I was just interested, how did we get this expression? And then I found a little bit more about Buckley himself. I thought, this must be a story that we've got to tell. I mean, he's a white guy among Aborigines. It's a big thing here in Australia about reconciliation with our native people. Here's a story about conciliation back in 1803. So I thought it had relevance with today.
Yeah. So let's just start with William Buckley himself. What do we know about his early life in England and how he found himself in Australia?
Yeah, well, you know, you probably know that around about the 1760s onwards, Britain wanted to get rid of all of its, what they would call their riffraff, the people, anyone who stole a loaf of bread, anyone who did the slightest misdemeanor was sent down to the colonies from about 1780 onwards, because they simply wanted to. The prisons were being too crowded. that cities, because it was the Industrial Revolution, were getting too crowded. So they tried to remove, as it were, all their, basically the lower class, the poor and dispossessed. So they founded Australia, and Buckley was one of those who came from a very poor little town in Cheshire in central England called Marton. What happened to him, his family were dispossessed of their land because by the 1780s and early 1790s, there was a war with France. So the government needed his land, and so they just took it. It's a bit like the Grapes of Wrath situation that you have in America, where people just went off the land because it was just taken from them, and they had to leave. So he was destined for a sort of life of crime. He became an apprentice bricklayer, but we think he was a bit, you know, he did a little bit of criminal activity as well. This is what happened to dispossessed people of that time. He actually went into the army, fought against Napoleon in Holland in the 1790s, and came back to England and fell in with the wrong crowd, and he was caught fencing or selling Irish cloth. What exactly Irish cloth is? It was very valuable, and he was sentenced to be hanged. But they commuted that because they wanted to send all these people down to the colonies. And before he knew it, by the age of 22, he was found himself on the southern coast of Australia in a new colony that was just starting out in late 1803.
So tell us what life would have been like in a convict colony in Australia in the late 1700s, early 1800s.
Yeah, it would have been very basic. You know, it would have been like most basic camp. The funny thing about it was this is a settlement, so it wasn't just convicts. It was convicts convicts would be on one side of the beach in their, you know, calico tents, and then there was a lot of gentry because they were settling this thing, and the gentry were there to take land and own the land. So they had all these. They had much more. How should I say, resources? So they had proper tents, and the commandant was on the top of the hill there, and you had to all report to him. And there were a lot of soldiers around, so the convicts were being overseen. So one side you had sort of the poor old convicts doing all the drudgery and all the hard work, and on the other side you had all the others sort of cavorting and having a lovely time while everybody did the work around them. It was very much a class system. So you've got this little colony which echoes the sort of class system that you had back in Britain. So it was a very big drudge for people like William Buckley, and not such a bad place not to be for, you know, sort of an Arcadian wilderness for the gentry who had everything done for them.
So in this time and place, there are convicts, gentry, as you've just said, but also bushrangers. Can you explain what a bushranger was?
Yeah, what happened was the bushrangers weren't there at that time. This is very early in the Australia was settled in Sydney in 1788, and bushrangers didn't really come on till maybe about the mid 1810, 1811. What happened was a lot of the actual convicts were either fled, but this particular settlement there were no bushrangers because there were no white people around. It was just this colony. But there were convicts who fled and who were capable and learned to live on the land. They mostly learned this from the Aboriginal people. They watched the Aboriginal people, saw how they lived off the land. And the bushrangers came in probably 7 or 8 years after, because then the convicts had either fled or they'd actually got their freedom and decided to become bushrangers anyway because they had no hope. So what happened, I should explain, I don't want to get too much into this, but this particular settlement failed. So within 3 months of Buckley being there, they decided to pack off and go to Tasmania, which is, I'm sure you know, is a little island south. So Buckley said, I don't want to go to Tasmania. I'm going to go and flee, and I'm going to go into the woods, and I'm going to try and make a life for myself alone. So he fled with six other people up the peninsula, and the other five dropped off until he was the only one alone. And there he was, completely alone in the wilderness, a 22-year-old guy, with no bush skills practically at all, having to fend for himself and only what he thought were going to be aggressive Aboriginal people around him. I hope that gives the context.
Absolutely. So William Buckley, you've already mentioned his height. He's an imposing character, and he played a pivotal, important role in the military.
Yeah, he was what they actually called, as you rightly say, a pivot man. You can imagine the guy, he's one of those guys you see in the old sort of things of Napoleonic arm, you know, Napoleonic time, where a man would turn right and the whole wing, he'd sort of wheel the entire line of men around him. So, yeah, he was imposing because he was 6 foot five and 7 eighths, they would say. So he was basically 6 foot six, which I think is about 190 centimetres. But he was a huge man because in those days, a tall man was around 5 foot seven. That was pretty tall. Most guys were around 5 foot four, 5 foot five. At 6 foot five, he was gargantuan. But the thing about Buckley was he was a very much one of those gentle giants. He was highly athletic, extremely strong, very capable athletically. So he could run for hours and hours, and he did such. When he fled from the settlement, he ran for about 3 or 4 hours nonstop. As no one could keep up with him. So yes, he was very strong, but always very kind and very gentle man, and never did anybody any disservice that I ever heard of.
It ends up being a pretty harrowing journey for him. His compatriots lose hope, turn around, go back. He continues on alone into the wilderness. What was his first contact like with the Aborigines?
Yeah, he was lost, pretty much lost in the wilderness, and he was getting extremely desperate, and he decided to try and go back. And this was about 3 months after he'd actually fled from the convict, and he thought that he could go back around and meet, go back to the colony and meet his fate, which he probably would have been whipped or put in the stocks or whatever. But on his way, he just started to lose. It was winter, and he just started to lose power. He just had no more strength left. He got to a little place in an area called the Bellarine Peninsula, and he forded a stream, and really that was the last of his strength. But what he had done just previously, he'd found a grave, and on the grave was a spear. It was a spear of a warrior, and he took it, knowing that he was desecrating the grave, but he took it thinking, well, maybe he could possibly use it to hunt or just as a walking stick. So he was found by the Aboriginal people. I think it was three women found him half dead on the banks of a river with the spear of a warrior they knew. And they kind of resuscitated him, and they were screaming and wailing and all kinds of, they looked as if they couldn't believe that it was him, and as if they knew him. And he didn't really understand, why are these people getting so upset about me being here? And it turns out, and it's happened many times since, that they believed that Buckley was that man who was in the grave, a man they called Murungurk. The Aborigines believed that when you died, your spirit went over the seas, and if you loved your country enough, your spirit would return. And they believe Buckley was Murungurk, the man in the grave, returned because he had Murungurk's spear. Now, you didn't have to look like Murungurk; you could just be tall, and they would still think that it was him. But that was the evidence. And so you can imagine for them what this was like. They thought their lost person who had died, Murungurk, had now come back simply because he loved them so much. And they went, how can I say, they went nuts, they went crazy. They couldn't, it was like a man being resurrected. They believed Murungurk had come back to life to come back to see them. And so it was a very strange meeting for Buckley the first time, because they were giving him everything he wanted. They were treating him with kid gloves. They were putting him by the fire. They were looking after them. They were giving him food. And Buckley had been 3 months in the wilderness with no one's help at all. And suddenly these people were so kind and gentle and friendly to him, and he couldn't work out what was going on. So that was a quite funny, strange first meeting with the Aboriginal people.
What year did this happen in, and what part of Australia did he find himself in?
Right. So where if you know the city of Melbourne, it's around Port Phillip Bay. So it's a big bay in the very southern part, the very southeastern corner of Australia. So he had gone past Melbourne to a place called Geelong, and we're talking about we're now in 1804, because he'd been on the run, or whatever you want to call it. He'd been in the wilderness for 3 months. They had arrived in 1803, and by 1804, 3 or 4 months in, that was around about when he was found by the Aborigines around the Bellarine Peninsula. You'd have to look on it on a map, but it's a very southeastern corner of Australia that we're talking about here.
Perfect. Thank you. Would you tell us about the indigenous people in Australia? Were the Aborigines divided into tribes, clans?
Yeah.
What were the similarities amongst these clans, the differences?
Yeah, where he was around the Port Phillip area, there were five tribes. They actually called them the Kulin Nation. And they all, I don't think it's unlike what the American Indians had. They had tribes, big tribes of probably several thousand. And various clans lived in various parts. And those clans knew that area and they'd lived in that area. And you never left that. Well, you did leave that area to hunt and gather, but you never really left it, as it were. That was your home. And all the clans knew exactly what part of the country they were in, what part of the country they were. And so there would be a great knowledge between various clans and intertribal. So when the Wadawurrung, which was the tribe that he was with, he belonged to the Barrabool clan, which is an area in the south of the Wadawurrung land. But then he would live it gets further subdivided down into bands. So he probably lived with a band that lived in a particular part. So it was very divided, but yet everybody knew each other, and everybody knew which clan you were in, what tribe, and the Wadawurrung spoke the same language, but just next to them was another tribe or nation, if you like, another tribe that spoke a very similar language. So the Kulin Nation, which was about five tribes, all spoke a very similar language. So they were sort of connected. So it's often there were marriages between tribes. So they were very well connected with their family, and everybody knew everybody's place. They knew that you were this person's uncle, you know, this person's auntie. You might have shared a grandfather, all that sort of thing. The Aboriginals kin was extremely important to them, and they knew exactly who you were through your line, through your ancestry.
Right. So this first meeting, he's lavished with food, grubs, water, very hungry, very grateful. I think you write that they even build a hut around him, but he's still a little bit wary. How long does it take for him to ingratiate himself into the clan?
I don't think it took very long, because he was taken to, you got it. Here's the other funny thing. He was taken by this clan that had met him to his actual family, because you got to remember, he's been resurrected. So he finds out now that he has a sister and he has a brother-in-law and I think two nephews and a niece. So they all believe that he is, the Murungurk. So they're treating him brilliantly. The problem for him is he just didn't understand why that was happening. He began to understand when he could begin to understand the language, and that would have taken a long time. It would have probably taken him a couple of years to master the language. But his big fear, it was always this belief among convicts, and it was told to them by the upper echelons, that if you go into the wilderness, you will be eaten by cannibals. They just believed that everybody was a cannibal, and yet there's no actual evidence of Aboriginal people being cannibals and eating for eating's sake. And yet this was the thing that Buckley feared. Every time he saw a fire, he thought he was going to be chucked in the fire and eaten. But he realized, I reckon, within two or three days, that these people were not going to harm him. They cared about him. Why they cared about him, he couldn't work out. But he's being treated with kid gloves. And he began to ingratiate himself, I would say, very quickly. It was very clear that they wanted him, and they wanted him to be there. Every time he used to leave camp and go and wash himself in the nearby river, they'd all be worried because he's been away for 10 minutes. Because here's the other funny thing, they believed he'd died. So they were treating him really well because they didn't want the man that had already died to die again. And so here's this funny situation where they're treating him overly kindly to make sure that nothing goes wrong for him.
So Buckley is not allowed to fight, right? He's kept away when his clan fights other clans.
That's right, yeah. He was never involved, or says he was never involved, in any form of aggression between rival clans, because they could have disputes, or rival tribes. I mean, there was all kinds of disputes that could happen. And he was kept distinct from them. But apparently there were certain situations. He learned to hunt, and he learned to use a spear as well, apparently as well as any of them. So there were situations where I believe he was threatened, and being a 6'5" guy, he said, "Don't mess with me, guys. I can hold my own," and I think he could. Within a few years, he was very adept. Whether he didn't actually take part in any fights or any interclanal or intertribal fights, but he was pretty adept with the spear and he knew how to use everything.
And he would be introduced by his own clan to members of other clans, right?
Yeah. They saw him, and you've got to remember that the Bush Telegraph, as we call it here, I'm probably the same in America. The Bush Telegraph was extremely good among Aboriginal people. They would have heard about Murungurk coming back, and everybody in the entire nation would have heard. So I draw a scene there where I think I can't be 100% sure, but he describes it in the source material that I used, and there was a great meeting of all the tribes, and that's talking about the whole Kulin nation here. And he was kind of put in the center, and everybody sort of looked at him for many minutes just to check whether they believed he was Murungurk or not. That's what he thinks. We don't know. But basically they were checking him out. And in the end, he was accepted not just by his clan and his tribe, but by everybody in the entire – he was well known. He became – William Buckley became – you know, the guy who the ghost who had come back, and everybody knew who he was. There's no doubt that he was famous within this much larger nation around the whole Port Phillip area.
And during his 3+ decades with the tribe, he's married as well.
Yeah, he did get married. I don't think it was a very happy marriage. He doesn't say a very big deal about it. He says that she went off with some other guy, and he went, "Oh, look, I don't mind. You know, we didn't really care for each other that much anyway." So far as any other marriages, there is, I do mention a woman in there who claimed to be his wife. We don't know, because it's the source material is very sketchy. It's not very clear where he might have met her. As for having kids, it's another one. We don't know who the wives were. We don't know the names of the kids. I wrote in the book that he had two sons, and then there was another situation where a woman in the 1870s claimed to be his granddaughter. So we just don't know who they were. But yes, he was married, but we don't think that marriage, that official marriage that he talks about, created any children. I don't think that was I think he had children by other women, but who they were, we don't know.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that,
Or
call the police, like she should have, exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. "I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?"
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Throughout history, royals across the world were notorious for incest. They married their own relatives in order to consolidate power and keep their blood blue. But they were oblivious to the havoc all this inbreeding was having on the health of their offspring. From Egyptian pharaohs marrying their own sisters to the Habsburgs' notoriously oversized lower jaws, I explore the most shocking incestuous relationships and tragically inbred individuals in royal history. And that's just episode one. On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ plus royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history. Join me every Tuesday for new episodes of the History Tea Time podcast, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
You know, I got the sense while reading your book, he was kind of a sensitive guy.
Yeah.
There is this really poignant moment in the book where this family that's adopted him, that he loves so much, the brother-in-law is killed, right?
That's right.
Would you mind telling that story?
Yeah, sure. It's hard to explain, but you have to understand the Aboriginal way of thinking, which I've only learnt myself while writing. What happens is if you're a far-off tribe, you're considered a threat. So those tribes who are outside the Kulin Nation, which is around the Port Phillip area, if you're beyond that area, you're considered an enemy. It's just the way it is. If they don't know you, if they don't have a linguistic or any kind of kinship with the other tribe, they're considered enemies. Now, what happened with Buckley is somebody from one of these tribes came to his tribe, and they actually looked after him, which is surprising because they don't usually look after absolute foreigners, people outside the Kulin Nation, but they did. He, as I understand it, was bitten by a snake, and he was given and was dead within a few days because the snakes in Australia, you may have heard, are very venomous. I think most snakes you don't want to go too near them. But this man was he was bitten by a snake and killed. Now what happened was they gave him the full burial rites. They treated him really well, but then a foreign tribe blamed Buckley's tribe for what had been done. It didn't matter that he was bitten by a snake. The way they saw it was that sorcery from Buckley's tribe had actually influenced the snake to bite him. That's how they think of it. Now, it's very strange because it's different cause and effect here. So they went and they believed that the sorcery came from Buckley's brother-in-law. So not only did they hunt down and kill Buckley's brother-in-law for the death by snake of their tribesman, They killed his wife, and I believe there was one of his daughters, I think. Well, I just can't remember exactly. But anyway, there was a revenge payback killing on Buckley's family from this foreign tribe. And the funny thing about it was after it had all been done, they said, "Oh, Mr. Buckley," they said, "Murungurk, would you like to come and join us?" And it was like they'd done business. It was a bit like a mafia killing. We didn't do this. It wasn't personal. It was business. It was like something they had to do. And Buckley just couldn't believe it, and he became very traumatized by this whole thing because what had his family done? Absolutely nothing. And yet they were killed for some strange reason related to sorcery. So these are the things that Buckley, as a white man, he still retained some of his white man cause and effect things, and he became estranged to some extent from the Aboriginal people for these kinds of things. He just never understood this kind of thinking.
And now a quick word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. So while he is living with this tribe, there are changes happening, as you've already alluded to. Western civilization is encroaching on their lands, and one of the primary characters leading this charge is John Batman.
Yeah.
The bounty hunter from your title, The Ghost and the Bounty Hunter. Can you tell us about his background and his place in Australian history?
Yeah, let me go back as best as I can. Batman was he was born in Sydney, so he's from the main colony, the biggest colony. He grew up, I believe he had a Presbyterian background, and his father believed that there was a sort of egalitarianism, that Presbyterian egalitarianism, that even people, the native people, which most people treated very badly, were considered equals. So Batman lived and with Aboriginal, as he grew up, he lived and worked with Aboriginal people, so he saw them as kind of equals. But you have to also understand there was another side of him. He had a very big chip on his shoulder because he was the first generation of Australians born in Australia. So he had British parents, but he was born in Australia. And he was what they call a currency lad. Why they call them currency lad, I don't know. But they're the first generation. And they always looked down upon by any British settlers as sort of second-rate people because they were actually native Australians in their own way. So he had a chip on his shoulder, and he was very ambitious. He was said as an 18, 19-year-old to have got a woman pregnant. It was all hushed up. He went off to Tasmania because Tasmania was then becoming quite a decent settlement, and he was able to get some land there. Now, the thing about Batman which made him very different from all of the other people who were settling in Tasmania was that he was a brilliant bushman because he knew the ways of the Aborigines. Now, the Aborigines, of course, knew the land far better than white people, but Batman was different because he had lived and worked with them and knew how to live off the land. So he got some land, but he also knew how to go bush, and he knew how to forage, and he was a native in that sense. So I tell the story of Batman. Batman started to work. See, there's a thing about he was very ambitious. He, at that time in the 1830s, 1820s, I should say, he was conscripted, so to speak, by the government to get rid of Aborigines because the Aborigines were threatening the settlers there. And, of course, Batman was a brilliant bushman, so they needed a man like him. So he switched on the people he was supposedly his friends, the Aborigines. He basically switched on them and started hunting them. And he did it for the government because the government gave him that ability to do so, and he would be rewarded for doing so. So it's not a very good story at all. In the 1820s, Batman heard about Port Phillip, where Buckley was. An explorer had been there. And because Tasmania, he thought, was overcrowded, and he wasn't given what his due, he thought, I want to make a settlement in this virgin land just across the water. So Tasmania is just across the water from where Buckley is, just about a day's sailing. But the government said, you know, you're not allowed to. We don't have a settlement there. You're not allowed to take land. But Batman dreamed of going to where Buckley was, Wadawurrung land. And the other thing about Batman is worth knowing is that by the 1830s, it became clear that he was dying from syphilis. And in syphilis in those days was extremely debilitating. And by the mid-1830s, he had to put a bandana over his nose because his nose was being eaten away by the syphilis. Batman still had this dream, and he wanted to take land in Port Phillip, so he just got on a boat. He said, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. Got on a boat, still syphilitic, but still quite capable. The syphilis hadn't got to him at that point. And basically docked in Buckley's land, in the Wadawurrung country. And then went in search of the native elders to try and do a deal. And that's where the two stories converge. He met some elders, and he did what he believed was a deal, which gave him some land there. I don't believe it was any kind of deal. I think the native people, the people said, understood that he wanted to stay there, and they said, you can bring your family and you can live there for some time. But they didn't actually know that they were doing a deal for hundreds of thousands of hectares of land. So Batman goes back to Tasmania and says, look, I'm the biggest landholder I've got 600,000 hectares, I think it was. And then everybody heard about it, and everybody said, we've got to go and do this as well. So Batman was a start. And the next thing you know, Buckley meets some of the landing party, I should say, of Batman. And that's where Buckley first, after 32 years, meets white men all over again for the first time.
I want to ask you about that meeting, but before we get to it, I'd like to ask you about Batman's reputation as a bounty hunter. We talk a lot about outlaws on this show.
Yes.
And Australia has more than its share of mythical outlaw characters.
Yes.
He captured two, a man named Jeffries and a man named Brady. Would you tell us about them?
Yeah, well, of course, Batman was before they called it, in Tasmania, before they decided they wanted to clear the country of all indigenous people, they had to clear the country of the bushrangers. Now, you were talking to me earlier about the bushrangers. They started to come into being around after about 1810, because by then, as I said, many had escaped. They'd gone bush. They knew enough about the land to live off it. And there were people like Brady and Jeffries. They're both very different. Now, Brady was a gentleman type, and he was probably the most brilliant, except he never – he was most brilliant, and he knew how to work the land as well as anyone and evade everybody. There were convicts that went out to find him, but he was just too smart and too quick. It turned out that he was injured in the leg, and by sheer chance, Batman was out trying to find him, and he moved towards Batman at this particular time in 1824, 1825. And Batman, he found his scent, basically, and Batman was every bit as good a bushman as Brady. So it was the two great bushmen. There was a bush ranger, Brady, who knew how to handle himself in the Australian wilderness, and then there was Batman, the bounty hunter. So first he was a bounty hunter for bushrangers, let's make this clear, and then later became a bounty hunter for Aborigines. Because he was such a brilliant tracker, he eventually came and found Brady. And Brady knew exactly who Batman was. And he just gave himself up because he knew that there's no way, he was injured, that he could escape from such a brilliant bushman like Batman. And eventually Brady was taken in and was hanged. And but much to the very sadness of, because he was seen as a great savior, as the man who defied the colonial rule. Matthew Brady was very much beloved. But Batman got the best of him, I'm afraid.
So Brady was the much beloved outlaw, and Jeffries, you've already talked a bit about cannibalism and the myth that Aborigines practiced it. Not true, but this bushranger named Jeffries was allegedly a cannibal.
Yeah, no, there were a few white. If there were any cannibals in Australia, they were white, and they were Europeans. The very famous story about Alexander Pierce, another convict who escaped and became a kind of bushranger in a way. Yes, he was a bushranger. He left the western side of Tasmania and got to Hobart, which is on the eastern side. And the only way he survived, because nobody else has survived, was along the way he and six others, basically, they all ate each other, so to speak. And he was the last man standing. He was the last man who ate the sixth person, who, because he was able to do that, made it to the other side. And we're talking about some of the most tough country on earth. And he only made it through because he could eat the others. It was a terrible story. Jeffries, I don't know too much about his cannibalism, except that he was said to have eaten other men. he claimed it. He said he did. And, of course, this was abhorrent to everybody. Jeffries was a degenerate. I mean, not only was he a cannibal, he raped women. He killed people. He was the absolute antithesis of Brady, who was the Dick Turpin of Australia, if you like, the sort of highwayman-type gentleman. You know, he was the lowest of the lows. And apparently I read somewhere that Jeffries was in Brady's group and Brady just expelled him because the guy was a total degenerate. I think we're talking about real rough character in Jeffries.
Interesting. So back to Buckley. It's a moving moment when he realizes that the white men are coming. He'd lived so long in blissful ignorance, and he'd even forgotten how to speak English.
Yeah, that's true. When he got to the camp in 1835, when white man actually came back to settle, he arrived in the camp and he sat there at the end of the camp, this huge, imposing 6'5" white guy, clearly a white guy, but dressed as an Aboriginal and obviously knew the Aboriginal ways. He'd forgotten how to speak English. I should say that he knew that there were white men, there were sealers and whalers on the coast, but they treated the Aboriginal people appallingly as a whole, and he didn't want to be part of them. They were just not people he wanted to be part of. He was a gentle guy who loved his people by this time. By the 1835, he was a Wadawurrung. who had had a past as a white. He had more years as an Aboriginal than he had as a white. So he enters the camp, and they just couldn't believe what they were seeing. I mean, where did this white man just step out from? Where did he come from? And he's gigantic to boot. And so they start asking him questions, and eventually he remembers somebody gives him a piece of bread, and he said, it was like a cloud passing over my brain, and he said the word bread, and that was his first English word in 32 years. And then I think it started to come back. After a few weeks, he could probably speak reasonable English and tell his story. It would have taken a little while, but it all came back after a while.
He obviously now has to walk a fine line, do a balancing act between both sides.
Yes, that's exactly right. He has to be kind of an agent for both, but an agent for neither. So he's playing a double game here. He wants to help the white people, and there's a reason for that. He knew that he was going to be seen as an escaped convict and could be sent off, because he knew that he had to ingratiate himself with the white people who had come, because if he didn't, it would be, you know, he wouldn't get his freedom, because technically he was still an escaped convict, even 32 years later. So he wanted a pardon. So that's why he had to be mates or friends with the white people. And I think because he wanted to be, he was a generous guy who just simply wanted to, he didn't want any trouble. He was known as a peacemaker. And he probably liked the white guys that he met. Batman's people that he'd left there were probably nice to him, and they looked after him, and they fed him, and they looked after him. At the same time, he was now a Wadawurrung person. Now, the Wadawurrung saw these white people encamped on their land. Now, there's a very important part of the story that you cannot just walk onto Aboriginal land and say, hello, how are you? You have to give gifts. If they were going to stay on the land, they had to give something back. And, of course, they did try to give gifts, but it wasn't enough. They were just a very small enclave of eight people. And then more Wadawurrung came and said, well, where's our stuff? So Buckley had to step in. Buckley stepped in and said, don't kill these people. Don't kill them. Don't you realize these white people, they're coming back. There's going to be another ship, and if you kill them now, you won't get any of all the gifts that they're going to be bringing for you. And they go, oh, yes, of course, if we kill them now. Then, so he's playing this game where he's playing each other off. So he's telling the white people that it's no problem, you're okay, you can stay here, we don't mind, there's no problems at all. And then he's telling the indigenous people, his family and his fellow tribesmen, don't kill them now, because if you do, you won't be getting anything from them. So he managed to keep them apart. And actually, they get on okay. Within the white camp were five Aboriginal people from Sydney. Now, these would have been seen as foreigners. Yet, funnily enough, the Wadawurrung actually got on really well with them, because they corroborated together. They went out kangaroo hunting. So the whole point was that the white camp ingratiated themselves as best they could with the Wadawurrung people, but there was always a threat coming over them that if they didn't give anything back, they could be killed. But luckily, another ship came, and they were given all kinds of trinkets, and they loved axes. The Aboriginal people loved it. They had multiple uses for white man's axes, because it could be used to cut trees, it could be used to skin animals. It was the best piece of equipment they'd ever seen, and they were crazy about axes. And of course, the white people realized that they wanted their axes, so they brought them by the truckload, and that ingratiated themselves with the local people.
How long is Buckley able to keep peace between the two sides?
I think roughly about, I don't remember exact, but I think he kept the peace between the two sides for about 4 to 5 weeks until another ship came. And you can imagine his relief when the ship came, because then, of course, the Aborigines saw these wonderful gifts coming towards them, and they forgot all about killing the white people that were at the camp. But Buckley also realized that the more white people came, the more they would be encroaching on Aboriginal land. So he knew what was happening here. He knew that the more ships came and gave the Aboriginal people all these things that they wanted, the more the white people could have a foothold on this piece of land. And he knew that what was coming. He knew exactly that more ships, more whites, equals more appropriation of Aboriginal land. He knew there was going to be a problem down the line.
Was he able to help soften that blow?
I think he did. He did for a year or so. More white people came. He was used as the interpreter. They were given more gifts. The camp moved from into what is now Melbourne, and that's where Melbourne pretty much started. Batman arrived and a few others, and some more whites arrived. But at this point in 1835, 1836, There were still very few white people. And because the white people were freely giving at this very early juncture, this very early time, they were giving in 1835, 1836, they were giving back a lot to the Abbots. So it was a very fair society for about a year, year and a half. First year, year and a half of the settlement of Melbourne was a very peaceable one. The white people lived with the black people. There was very much mixing. There was an equality there. There was nobody trying to usurp the other people's land. It worked quite well. And Buckley was the sort of instrument there. He was the only one who spoke the language. So he, whenever white men needed to tell their Aboriginal people certain things, he could do that. And then they would relay their thoughts back via Buckley. So he became the go-between. He became very important to both sides to get their messages and their views across.
What happened after a year or so? Why did things change?
Well, I say it in the book, but you can't exactly find a turning point. When did things start to turn sour? I think it happened when a man called Charles Franks was killed. I think that's about mid-1836, sometime around 1836. He was a landowner. Of course, by that time there were the first landowners coming and taking the land. And, of course, they were dispossessing the Aboriginal people of the land, and that was causing rancor in itself. But it wasn't causing serious rancor because many of the landowners realized, well, we better give the Aboriginal people, access to their own land. It was working okay, but then Franks was killed. And the reason we don't know why Franks was killed by the native people, except it was believed that he was either giving them poison food, he hated them, and he was giving them, or he was shooting them. So at some point he was killed. Now, that caused an uproar because Franks wasn't your everyday convict. He wasn't your everyday person. He was a landowner and much liked. And the landlords, if you want to call them that, the settlers, said, if they can kill him, they can kill us. So they went out on a reprisal, and they took 12, 15 men out for a reprisal killing for the men who killed Franks. And it's said they killed 12, but many believe that they killed maybe upwards of 30 Aboriginal people. And that's when things started to really turn sour. And then the reprisals just kept coming. And from then on, it was not a nice place to be. And Buckley, of course, saw all this happening. He feared this would happen in the first place. And suddenly it was all coming unstuck by late 1836, early 1837. So within 2 years, things had turned pretty sour between the native people and the newcomers, the invaders, so to speak.
How long does it take for the Aboriginal people in this area to be driven out, assimilated, or killed? What's the timeline here?
People here get it slightly wrong. They think that white people went out in droves and hunting parties, and like John Batman did in Tasmania, and go off and kill. And there were some of that. But what really destroyed the Aboriginal culture was the fact that the white men were bringing in sheep, and the sheep would eat all the native food. And the most important native food, almost a staple, more than kangaroo, more than any possums, more than the wildlife, was a thing called murnong. And murnong was a yam. And it's a very funny, interesting thing that at the very, very same time that the murnong, the sheep were eating, the sheep were taking all the land and they were eating the roots of the murnong. And they reckon within 3 or 4 years, millions of acres of murnong had just been eaten up by the sheep, because by this time it was perfect grazing land. The sheep, there was maybe several hundred thousand sheep by the late 1830s. So the people were started to spear sheep because they couldn't get their native foods. It was being eaten up. So the real killer, if you like, of Aborigines was not the fact, it was not white men going out and hunting them. It was the fact that their native foods were decimated. So that meant that once they were not allowed onto their own lands, and their own lands were being eaten up anyway, the only place they could get food was Melbourne. So many tribal people encroached on Melbourne, and then the Melbourne people said, we don't want Aborigines here. Make sure they don't come in. So suddenly these people became not even dispossessed of their land, they weren't even allowed into the main settlement. And then, of course, there was disease. Many of them got syphilis and all kinds of venereal disease, but also smallpox, and white men gave them all kinds of diseases. So these people were being decimated, but not by killing per se, although that happened. I'm not saying that there weren't killings out there. There were some terrible reprisals. But they gave back too. They killed white people too. There was an evenness, but the white men, of course, had more superior technology. But the real killer, the real destroyer of people, was the desecration of their lands, which took away the food source, and of course all the diseases that white man brought with him. So that combination was just too powerful; they could not survive it.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of the Plains Indians in America. Millions of buffalo wiped out by Western expansion. Their primary source of food and material for making necessities.
Here's the funny thing. I was going to allude to. The funny thing is that at the very same time that the Aboriginals were suffering a yam famine was the very same time as the Irish potato famine. And for all the same reasons, once you've taken the main form of sustenance, as the British did to the Irish, and as the British or the Australians or whatever you want to call it, did to the Aborigines, they've got no hope. And look what happened to Ireland. It became impoverished. They all left Ireland and went to the United States or Australia, many of them. It's not just a thing that happened to indigenous people. It happened to the Irish as well. They were starved of their own food sources.
So what becomes of William Buckley?
Buckley became fed up in the end. He watched as his people were being, driven off and deracinated. And he noted that the many thousands he knew when he first started out were no longer many thousands. There were no children being born. It was a very rough time. And he didn't want to be the mouthpiece of the white man anymore. You see, if you became the white man was becoming increasingly more aggressive, so the correspondence via Buckley was basically an aggressive one towards the very people he felt he was part of. So they thought of him, the Aboriginal people were beginning to think of him as a turncoat, as a betrayer, as a traitor. They didn't trust him anymore. And the white men, of course, thought that Buckley was half savage. They used to say he was a savage and he had no brains. And, of course, he was neither of those things. But he was half of something, and I think he just got fed up. So he said, I've had enough of this. He'd been given his freedom. He'd been in the interim. He'd been given his pardon. And, you know, after that he said, I'm going to Tasmania where I'm a nobody, and the next 20 years of his life had a very, very quiet life. So not a great deal happened except that the book was written by – he finally did his book about what happened to him in the 1850s, only I think 3 or 4 years before he died. And it became a sensation, that book. It was called William Buckley, The Wild White Man and His Adventures, something along those lines. But that's the source book from which we know a lot of what happened to Buckley. It's not completely accurate. There are other sources of material, because some of the parts of the book were just exaggerated, I think. But yes, he had a very quiet life. And in the end, he became a sort of courier, and he was... I think he was in his 70s. He was quite an old man when he was on a gig, which is just a little stagecoach, and he was delivering some parcels. And that stagecoach, the gig we call it, overturned and he broke his back. And I think within 2 or 3 months, he was a very old guy by this. He was in his 70s. He died a very lonely death. He had a wife, and he sort of died ignominiously, but people remembered him, and he became quite a legend. And as I said at the very beginning, I think people began to use expression, you've got Buckleys. Even though he died a sort of lonely death, and he became part of the Australian idiomatic speech, and at least something survived of him.
Yes, for sure. So this is a great book. I just want to briefly mention, though, another great book of yours, The Ship That Never Was.
Yes.
Wish we had time to do that one, too. Would you summarize that one for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the first, I seem to have become the convict writer. I don't know why. I didn't set out that way to be.
Ah, we love that here.
I definitely think my next book's not going to be about a convict. It's just the way it happened. But my first book, The Ship That Never Was, I should try and give an elevator pitch, but it's about another convict who was sent down to Tasmania. He went to a place called Macquarie Harbour, which is where they sent all the worst recalcitrants. He tried to escape at least 7 or 8 times from this place and failed, but luckily fell in with a crew who, when they were abandoning that particular settlement in the 1830s, he fell in with a crew, and there was a very smart guy. He said, there's one last ship going out from this thing, and we're going to take it, and we're going to sail it. And long story cut short, James Porter, the main man, he and nine other guys steal the boat and sail it all the way to Chile. Can you believe it? They sail it across the Pacific, across the Southern Ocean, and they took it all the way. So this is a bunch of motley crew of sailors. And this is absolutely true. They took this last brig that came out of this settlement, and they took it all the way to Chile, and they became quite famous in Chile. And the British said, we can't have this. We've got to go after them. And the story is about what happened then. So I'll leave it at that.
Perfect, perfect. Well, people can buy your book on Amazon, I know. I didn't check to see if it's out in paperback here in the States. I got the ebook version.
I think you can get it, and don't quote me on this. I think it's you can get it at Barnes & Noble in the US as a paperback. So, but it's definitely an ebook. You can definitely get the ebook, but The Ship That Never Was, you can get it as a paperback. I know that. Whether that The Ghost and the Bounty Hunter, my second book, is available, I'm fairly sure. I'd have to check. You'd have to check that. But it's definitely only in the US as an ebook. But you could buy it and have it shipped out all the way from Australia, but that's probably very expensive.
Sure, sure.
But I do hope my American friends can get a chance to read a bit about the Australian history. There's a very rich history. It's worth reading.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Eric, and I'm really, really glad that I'm speaking to somebody in the U.S. because it's totally different, and I have to. It's a different way of doing things, but I really enjoyed it.
Well, I appreciate it as well. Again, I have been speaking to Adam Courtney. He is the author of The Ghost and the Bounty Hunter. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobweb corner of the world. Please, I hope you're staying safe. Please wash your hands. Please keep your distance. It helps us all in the long run. And have the safest of tomorrows.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.